Enjoy the freedom to do more with the Samsung Galaxy Watch, now available at John Lewis and Partners. With built-in GPS, you can track your wellness routine, whether it's running, cycling or sleeping. Plus, with up to 4 days of battery life, you can live the fast-paced life without a worry. John Lewis and Partners. For us, it's personal. See online for details.
Hey, this is Chris. I'm just here to give you a little heads up before you listen. This is our My Neighbour Totoro episode, so it's an eagerly awaited episode, and we had a great time doing this. But unfortunately, when I came to listen to it, I discovered, for some reason, my audio had picked up my internal laptop mic instead of my external mic, so I sound a bit different. It's alright, it's not unlistenable, it's a bit annoying for me, but I did just want to let you know why it sounds like it does. But I think it's a really good episode, so hey, let's go, and after the music, you'll hear me again, but I'll sound a bit different, and I'll speak to you again soon. Bye!
Well, hello there, and welcome to the AFA podcast, the official podcast of animationforadults.com. If this is your first episode listening, you can find all our previous episodes on animationforadults.com itself under the podcast tab. You can find us on Apple Podcasts, on Stitcher, on podcast.com, and on your favourite podcast platform, and also on the Listen Notes podcast search engine. That's a new thing that we're also on. Yeah, that's cool. So today we are going to be talking about one film, and one film only, and it's a very important film in the history of animation, and that is My Neighbour Totoro.
Totoro.
Okay, you say Totoro, I say Totoro. Let's call the whole thing off. Boom.
You say Totoro, I say Totoro.
And as you can hear, I'm not alone. I am joined by Dan. Hello, Dan.
Hello.
And Rachel. Hi, Rachel.
Hey, everybody.
Yeah, so we are here to talk about Hayao Miyazaki's 1988 classic, My Neighbour Totoro, 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 Tomato, whatever. whether you say My Neighbour with a U in it or without, it doesn't matter.
I'm saying it with the U.
Yeah.
Just so okay. You know, yeah.
Okay. Whatever. It's My Neighbour Totoro, Totoro, Totoro. I'm not going to do it every time. and it has been screening in the US via G-Kids as part of the Fathom Events Ghibli Fest 2018 screenings for its 30th anniversary. So yep. We thought, perfect time to finally discuss this film.
Yep.
And
happy during the anniversary.
And we're just going to be talking about that. No news or anything this week. So let's get stuck in, I guess.
Yeah, right.
I will say, before we go any further, we decided that we're just going to talk about the film without worrying about spoiling anyone, because not just because it's 30 years old, because I don't really agree with the idea that just because the film's old.
Well, the film got popular, like, probably, it got popular like 10 years ago, right? Like, that was like the height of its actual, at least in the Western sphere.
Yeah,
like,
I believe so.
Yeah, so we're not saying because it's old, you can't talk, it's all right to spoil, but we just don't think that it's the kind of film that you can spoil by talking about plot details or whatever, so...
Do you want to hear the most damning thing that I've ever heard anyone say about this film?
What?
So I was talking about it with a friend of mine who was very, very dismissive of, this was probably about 6 or so years ago. And I was just gushing about the film. I was like, you gotta see this film. It's bloody amazing. And, my friend turned around and he said, well, I've looked at the art book for Totoro. So I've basically seen the film.
Oh,
and I think like that's the fairest, most damning thing anyone can say about the film, because it is light on story.
Yeah.
Which is, you know, actually it's strength. Like it's, yeah. It's not about the story you have or how much story you have. It's the way you tell it.
Exactly.
But if you have not seen it and you absolutely don't want to know anything before you go in, I guess come back and listen to this after you've seen it or not, or whatever. But we are just going to talk about it, and we're not going to worry about tiptoeing around spoilers, whatever, because there kind of really aren't any.
So, yeah, it's impossible to talk anything about the film without spoiling it. Yeah.
Yeah. So
we will be talking about the frog.
Yeah,
the tiny square little frog in the rain.
That's like the biggest spoiler.
And the goat and the snail.
Okay, so the goat. Okay, the frog and the goat are the. They steal the show. They absolutely steal the show. That goat is the baddest villain,
and it's the terrifying. Okay,
like, the scariest thing. Yeah, you always forget about the goat. And it's like this full on, like, looking at the Satan in the face.
We're starting with the deep cuts. Have you seen The Witch? It's like Black Phillip.
It's Black Phillip. It's horrific. And May has every reason to run away. Because who wouldn't? Actually, that's not what makes her run away, but it gives her a fright.
Yes, it does. It does startle her. Yeah, May is not a girl who scares easily, and she'll tell you so quite often.
It's one of her first lines. She's not scared.
Yep. See?
She's not scared, and yeah, that's why she sees Totoro, friend. So
yeah,
it's a film. It's a film, and it was made by, it was directed by Hayao Miyazaki, who, I mean, like, this is probably the film that made him a household name, right? At least in Japan.
Although, supposedly, it was actually their weakest box office opening at the time, at first. And it wasn't until it aired on television that it really took off.
This is the thing. It aired on TV, and famously, Ghibli didn't release their films on video. They didn't release their films on video until Disney stepped in with the worldwide like distribution or the US distribution deal. And only after that point did they actually start producing videos. Until then, if you had Totoro on DVD, on video in Japan, it was because you'd recorded it on the TV. Which is, I mean, that doesn't really happen so much anymore, but I guess that happened with certain, like, that happened with The Christmas Story in America, right? It was just on TV and it didn't particularly do very well, but because it was just on TV, it became a classic.
That is correct.
I don't know if there's anything like that in the UK so much. Maybe The Snowman, I guess. Just tradition Christmas things, right?
I don't believe... I did not live in London long enough to pick up on that, fortunately.
Oh, I was asking Chris, who was absent from his own podcast.
Sorry, I'm here, sorry. No, I don't think there was really anything like that in the UK. Christmas specials.
The holiday episodes of Only Fools and Horses, I guess. I don't know. I don't mean the Christmas ones. I mean the ones where they went to, like, Magaluf.
Or Wallace Gromit?
Yeah. Actually, yeah, I guess animation is... Yeah, that's actually true. Yeah, animation is one of those things that that does that. Anyway, like Chris, I watched the Blu-ray of this, and it's great. I mean, the Blu-ray puts the DVD to shame because it's a beautiful new transfer of the film. That's just so detailed and colourful and lovely, and it has, like, you can see the details in the picture. You can see that they used a different outline colour for the characters to make them sit nicer on the background. It's a technique that
beautiful.
It's a technique they didn't actually continue. I think they used it up until Kiki's Delivery Service, and after then they stopped using it. But what they were doing was, because in the old days with cell animation, you know, when you actually used to have to paint on a thing and it was photographed on a background, they used to just like transfer, like Xerox the drawings onto the acetates, onto the cells.
Yeah.
And in Totoro, they used a different toner. They used a brown toner, which, like, made a softer impression when you put the characters on the top of the backgrounds rather than having a black line.
Mm-hmm.
It was a brown line. Anyway, I'm sort of, like, constantly tripping myself up with this.
That's fine. I mean,
I'm getting to it. So he...
Okay.
Miyazaki is a guy, and he made a film in 1988, which was his fourth feature.
I think it was his fourth. Because Castle Cagliostro was his first? No, wait, was that Nausicaa? Am I getting that?
No, it was Cagliostro, Nausicaa, Laputa.
Uh-huh.
And this was, like, an idea that he'd had for like 15 years, apparently. He was, like, working in TV. He was working on series with Takahata, actually, like Heidi, Girl of the Alps, and things like that.
You've got a third.
Yeah, and they were making a, you know, that was when, it's fair to say, that's where his, like, creative origins begin, working with Takahata and being influenced by Takahata's attention to detail and his, like, appreciation for landscape and making that part of the story. And anyway, the point is that his life was hectic and he wanted a change of gears, and he just started drawing his own thing. He needed to just do something different. And around this time, he was actually making a few picture books. I think around this time is, like, when he made the first version of Princess Mononoke, which actually has a Totoro kind of creature in it.
Oh.
And he also did, like, another one called something like, it was something about, like, a boy and his sister. And his sister was, like, in a wheelchair. And this little boy makes an airplane for his sister, and he takes her on a flight. It's the most, like, Miyazaki book, and it's, like, kind of beautiful. Anyway, so he thought he was going to be a picture book.
Mm-hmm.
And he had, like, a few images from this picture book. He didn't actually ever make the Totoro picture book, but he had, like, the images of the girls. Originally, it was just one girl at a bus stop in the dark with this creature next to her. And they're both holding umbrellas because it's raining. And the other image he had was little creatures, and ones that were sort of semi-transparent. And a little girl being the only one able to see them.
Okay.
And he had those, and he was just, like, sitting with these ideas for, like, 15 years. And apparently he actually pitched the idea, after Nausicaa. He pitched the idea, and it was rejected because it just didn't appeal, actually. The whole thing the film was doing of, like, he wanted to do of making it a slow film, making it be more about the landscape, and it not having, like, robots or
flying machines.
Flying machines or magic in a cheaper sense where, you know, there was, like, fairy dust and things, right? It was not
Like actual concrete use of magic that people see and recognize.
Yeah, and like that's what makes the film so magical, is that it doesn't really have any of that stuff.
Mm-hmm.
I mean, it's got some bonkers stuff, but it doesn't have fairy dust, and it doesn't have like the typical lazy sort of things in it. You know, that it could very easily be.
There's, it's less direct is what it is. I mean, there is a sort of magic going on, but it's a natural magic. It's the magic of the natural world being put under a new lens.
Yeah, yeah, precisely. So, yeah, anyway, eventually he was making a name for himself, basically, as an animator. And he met Toshio Suzuki. Mm-hmm. And Suzuki saw something in Miyazaki, and he asked him to create a manga, pretty much for the purpose of turning it into an animation.
Mm-hmm.
And that was Nausicaa. So Miyazaki made Nausicaa, and he like adapted his own comic, and that was how he sort of... That was when Ghibli was founded.
Which I have to say, I actually I have the Nausicaa manga now, and I was looking through it, and it is amazing. To like, I've only read like maybe a quarter way through the first book,
mm-hmm.
and I feel like we've that one portion covered what was covered in the movie. So I'm just like, I'm really excited because I feel like I'm going into new territory with the story.
That the Nausicaa manga, yeah, it's the same experience of like watching Akira and like the manga just going beyond your wildest imagination. Yeah, with it.
I'm so excited.
But he hates it, apparently. Really? Adapting his own work, because it was apparently very torturous and he didn't enjoy the experience. Mm-hmm. But anyway, the thing is, the film was a big enough success, so Ghibli was set up.
Mm-hmm.
First Ghibli film, Laputa.
Yep.
You know, as much as it's a adventure film, it was, it hit all Miyazaki's original ideas.
Mm-hmm.
It was still like a film that they made because they knew it had to make money. It was, it was engineered to be a hit. It was engineered to be like a big summer fantasy film for kids.
Yeah, I can see that.
So like Totoro was like, that was the one he'd been waiting for. That was like, you know, finally he was like, okay, now I'm going to show you guys what my animation is about.
Mm-hmm.
Not that Peter and Nausicaa are not good by any. Oh yeah, they were great movies, but I think it's fair to say that Totoro was like, up until that point, his most personal film.
Mm.
And that was like him saying, you know, he was using up 15 years worth of like ideas and passion that he had been saving for this special project. So I think like even at the time it was a big deal for him.
That's like what are those directors' names? Those Disney directors, Musker and Clements. That was like them.
They're Hercules.
Yeah, that Hercules, so that they could get to Treasure Planet.
Yes, exactly. Yeah, they want. Yeah, exactly. And, I don't know what my thoughts are on Treasure Planet because I've not seen it for a long time.
It's okay, but
so I don't want to be unfair to that movie.
I'm just using that as a comparison. Like, okay, both of these, like Totoro was for Miyazaki what Treasure Planet was for those directors. It was something that they really wanted to work on for a long time, but they needed to prove themselves to.
Yeah, it was a passion project of kinds. Yeah, but it was it wasn't an irresponsible passion project, let's say that much. He's a very conscientious filmmaker.
Mm-hmm.
So basically he's like, Miyazaki's a city boy, actually, right? He didn't grow up in the country.
Mm-hmm.
He grew up in Tokyo, and he says it wasn't actually until he was in his 30s that he really rediscovered like nature and gave a shit about nature.
Mm-hmm.
So he wanted to make this film. He said it was like a letter to himself as a child. Like, look, check out how cool Japan is. Like, it's a beautiful country. And, you know, this is what you will miss out on if you're not careful, kind of thing.
Yeah, like, look at all these cool things that, you know, were right in your backyard.
Yeah, I mean, and I think there's plenty that he did take from his childhood. But there's also a feeling, I think, where he's like, I've got to, you know, like, pay my respects and, you know, worship at the altar of that massive tree that I've been neglecting, kind of thing.
Yeah, that's something I didn't pick up on until I watched it this time, and then I watched a bunch of the excellent special features on the Blu-ray edition, where there was some interview with Miyazaki and stuff, is the fact that the main characters in the film, Mei and Sasuke, are basically they're coming from the city. So
yeah,
seeing the, or somewhere more urban at least, so that basically all their wonder and everything is because they've never seen the country before, and it's showing the country through the eyes of like city children. It's yes. Like, wow, look at all these green things, the trees and stuff.
Mm-hmm.
It's like when a kid goes swimming in the city of London and sees their first cow or whatever, like, wow.
Hey, look, this tree doesn't have bars around the trunk.
Yeah, exactly. Yeah, it's weird because I guess this film is kind of, what happens with films that are way too popular, and I think it might have been kind of misreceived as something else. It's actually, yeah, and it wears that on its sleeve. Now, when you see it, it's clear. Like, it's not sort of, hey, wow, isn't it great living in the countryside kind of thing. It's actually, oh no, we need this retreat. We need this to happen. And if you guys have, like, you know, remembered, I have this idea that Miyazaki is obsessed with retreats.
Yeah.
In every single one of his movies. Every single one. About four-fifths of the way through the film, there is a retreat of some kind. That means a character stops off, takes a breath, gets back up on their feet, and runs into the finale. It's like, it happens
Kiki,
to...
Kiki goes to the cabin in the woods.
Kiki goes to the cabin in the woods.
Yeah.
Chihiro goes to the nice Yubaba in the woods.
And Nausicaa goes, or finds the area underneath the Forest of Corruption, which is actually not poisonous.
Yeah, and in the manga, four-fifths of the way through the whole saga, she goes and she visits someone who's ill in the hospital, in the magic hospital. Yeah, I'm not going to spoil it. that's when Sophie sees go through Hal's cave in his mind, and she sees him as a young boy swallowing.
Mm-hmm.
It's in every single one of his movies. You can just guarantee that's going to be there. And Totoro is like a whole movie of that. It's a whole movie of these kids going, and the whole family going through, look, we need to, for whatever reason, and it doesn't explain it, which is perfect. We need to move and we need to slow life down a bit because, you know, that's a necessary change that we need to go through.
Yeah, I think it was, it's implied that they moved closer because the hospital that the girl's mother is currently staying at is good ways out of Tokyo, and she's kind of like recuperating there, so they, I think they
right. moved closer. And the dad works at the university. He works at Tokyo University.
Mm-hmm.
So it's not like, it's not absolutely out in the sticks. They're like a couple of hours from Tokyo.
Yeah, so it's still the countryside, but not far enough that he can't go to and from Tokyo U by bus.
Yeah, no, exactly.
Train and by bus, excuse me. He implied, I recall a line where he said, oh, I had to take the train and then the bus.
going back to special features, there's one where they're going around locations. It's from like a NHK documentary or something, and it's like locations inspired by or that inspired Totoro, inspired the movie scenes and things. Mm. And there's actually a bit where someone says about how this isn't that far from the city or whatever, and that's I think that's kind of an important thing. I think I heard recently about how much of Japan is actually actually still, you know, nature, and there's huge urban areas, and then there's lots of countryside stuff.
Well, that's because of the mountains. Like, a lot of it is just not built on because it's just impossible. And they have, like, things like mountain tunnels because to connect, like, towns where they can build, they have to just go, well, there's this great big mountain in the way. We can't knock that down. We'll have to go through it.
Yeah.
So, like, it's not funny, but it's weird to revisit the film, because I think, like, we've all seen this film, right? Like,
yeah,
a while ago.
I saw this film back when I was, like, I think it was not long after my family and I had moved back from the UK, and I was moving back into Pennsylvania.
And what year was that?
Was that 2010? 2011. I think 2011.
Right.
And I don't know how long it was. It wasn't very long. And then...
it's 90 minutes.
Yeah. And so
it's a tight 90.
But I recall, because there was a video rental place back when those were still a thing. And there was a VHS tape, and I saw it, and I thought the character... You know, I think I wasn't sure if I was the one who picked it out, or my parents were the ones who picked it out, because they knew I liked cute things. So I was like, oh, this might be a nice film to watch. And I remember really enjoying it just for, you know, what it was, even though I didn't read that deeply into it at the time, because, you know, I wasn't at the age where you really read too much deeper into what you were shown. But I remember being really fascinated the fact that, you know, my brother and I have similar interests in a lot of things, but we're also very different. And I never thought that a film like this, like Totoro, which is basically focused around two girls, you know, who were roughly my age at the time, were like, I never expected him to get into it as much as he did. Every single time I sat down to watch that movie, he would find time to come sit down and watch it with me. And I'm like, I kind of look at him like, really? And he's like, yeah, I like it. I'm like, really? you're not watching or playing your race car games or your sports games or anything? He's like, no, I'll watch this. I'm like, okay.
Well, the films are a treat. It's like...
Yeah, so the fact that you're talking about it being a treat, that kind of makes sense now in hindsight.
And it does make sense as well, like, that it became popular with, you know, like, animation as its worst use, as we say, as a babysitter. Like, it's not a bad babysitting film.
No, it's not. At least, you know... For the ages that it's meant for, but it's, yeah, because, I mean, there's really nothing that jumps out or scares you, or...
The goat, sorry.
Well, there's the goat, yeah, the goat. That the goat is the one-time exception.
The goat is what made Totoro a hard R.
There's always got to be at least one jump scare, and the goat is as close as we get.
Yeah, the goat is like, yeah, if there was like one frame longer of the goat, it would be NC-17. It would not.
Yeah, but I remember that making like a real special like point in my mind about this film, was that the fact that this was something that my brother and I could genuinely enjoy together, and like throughout all the moments of us, you know, arguing and trying to compete with each other, like that was a movie we could both sit down to watch, or even get, you know, mom and dad to watch with us. And there was never a point of contention.
So, yeah. Yeah.
So Dan, when did you first see it?
Okay. So as everyone knows, my first Ghibli experience was not enjoying Spirited Away, I think. And then, Ponyo.
Oh, okay,
like,
yeah.
That was it. I can't remember which one I saw first, but the one that matters is Ponyo.
Yes.
And then it was literally like I was living at home, and opposite me, my friend lived. That was a very Yoda way to say that. my friend lived opposite me, and between us, like, we would spend our like wages, which were just like part-time supermarket wages at the time, each week going to HMV and buying a Ghibli or a couple. And it was like, okay, we went, I think after Ponyo, it was Kiki's Delivery Service.
Okay.
And then after that, it was Spirited Away. And then it was, I think Totoro was the next one. And I knew it was a big deal because I'd been like going to cons and things, and I'd like seen it on, you know, like cheap wallets that people had made and things like that.
The Totoro merch.
Yeah, I recognize the characters. I recognize the characters and all of that. And yeah, it's just a delightful film. Like, it doesn't put you... I watched it today and I've had a busy enough day, like moving things around and lifting heavy boxes, and I was exhausted. But Totoro put me in such a good mood.
I was
laughing like an idiot watching it, and I don't think that's just because I was deliriously tired. I think it's a good movie, and it's a funny movie as well.
It is. I'm not sure if it's intentionally or unintentionally, but a lot of the humor, at least for me, just comes from just the exuberance of these two main leads, of the two sisters. They're just so enraptured by everything new and unusual that you kind of just get a little bit, like almost kind of like with Ponyo later on, it's like you get a little bit that energy is contagious.
Yeah, and the movie like plays through their eyes, like particularly when they first move into the house, like you kind of see the dad like worrying about moving boxes and the radio, like, and but that's like all in the background, and the film is like concerned with, okay, look, we're with the kids here, we're gonna run around with them, and they don't actually do anything. They just run around and they sort of like
run around yelling, screaming, like, look at this, look at that, are those bunnies? I do have to point out, though, I really like how the film starts with when they're first driving to their new house.
And that's not how... Well, the film starts with a banger.
Oh, yeah, wait.
Musical number.
Yeah.
That's the start. That's the thing that, like, gets you pumped. I think.
Almost forgot about that.
And that's quite a throwback as well. That's a throwback. At the time, that was, like, a throwbacky thing to do. Because that's how Miyazaki opened his 1972 short film Panda Go Panda.
Oh,
and the sequel. And in fact, that was a throwback at that time to the old Toei movies that the same like kind of, look, we've got to do the credits at the front and we'll kind of get everyone into it by doing these little sort of like strips on the top and bottom of the screen, sort of teasing, like they're kind of like the sorts of illustrations that you see actually in the American version of Harry Potter, you know, the chapter illustrations. It's like just a little hint of like what's to come. And it's all like grotty stuff. It's like a spider and like an old rusty can and caterpillars and things, and it's such a good way to like get you to introduce you to the film.
I recall you see the little spirits that you see later on in the movie, little dust spirits too, as well as May walking around with her little hat and a bunch of little insects, if I recall correctly. But I like how when we're getting into the film proper, there's this one scene that never, at least when rewatching it, it never like jumped out at me before, but I really appreciated it here watching it recently. Was when they're driving to their new home, you know, you have their dad in the front seat with the driver, and the girls are actually in the back of the, you know, in the trunk, what did it say, the trunk of the car, or the bed of the truck, because there's a bunch of stuff piled onto the bed of the truck, including a desk.
On top of them. And it's
literally on top of these two little girls. There's hiding underneath the desk. And they see, like, a person, like, up on her a bicycle up ahead, and the both girls duck in, and then they look back at the person like, oh, it wasn't a cop.
Yeah, yeah.
It's like, oh, thank goodness, it wasn't a cop. We're not going to get in trouble.
Yeah, which is like a nice little hint of like the sort of, oh no, look, this is country life. It's just a friendly postman.
I just thought that was so funny. Like, I never picked up on that line before, and the fact that they were nervous about doing something like traveling illegally. But it's just like, man, that's how you can tell like these girls grew up in the city.
This film has been with me a long time.
Sorry, Chris, I didn't mean to like actually run off. You have known this film longer than any of us.
I think so.
Because I am as old as time, turning to dust in the wind. I did see this film. Not some real hipstery about it, but I did see it before most people in the UK probably got a chance to see it, just because that's how it worked out.
Before it was cool.
Yeah, it was my first experience with a Ghibli film, was with My Neighbor Totoro, and it was, I can't tell you exactly when it was, but it was sometime in the 90s somewhere, and I must have known about the existence of the film, because it was randomly shown on satellite television on a movie channel in the UK. They showed Totoro on one day, and then they showed Porco Rosso the next day. And they were dubs produced for Japan Airlines in-flight movies. So they were like early produced dubs. So I think it's the same one that was released by Fox later in the US.
Yeah, I think so.
So it was the dub featured the voice of the young May, was played by the same actress who played Angelica in the Rugrats.
No, okay. All right, that wasn't just me. All right, thank God.
May.
Yes. May was played by Angelica.
She was playing a dumb baby.
Yeah. Yeah. So
how did she feel about that?
Oh boy.
So I have very attached that old dub over the subsequent one with real children in it. a family friend used to occasionally record things off satellite for me if I saw them in like in the TV guide, and I was like, oh, I want to see that. And so I had a VHS with a double bill of those two films on it that I watched many, many times. To the point where when I watched the dub today, the Disney dub, in my head were occasional times when the translations differed and I could hear the original line.
Yep.
So you saw that version as well?
Yes, I did. So
the video released in the US on VHS was the same version that I saw. Yeah.
Yes, it was. And to be honest, I think I still have that same problem because I got so accustomed to that particular dub. You know, regardless of what you say about the quality of it, like that became like the voices in my head for these characters. So when I heard the film, you know, in the Disney dub years later, I'm like, I like it, and I still, you know, still like it as a whole. And I think, you know, the actors did a pretty good job. It's just, I don't know. Like you said, because of the translations differ, like I will hear them say a certain thing in the Disney dub, and like, wait, was the line supposed to be like this? But that's because they did it differently in that original dub. And it's just like, it's my nostalgia is kind of pulling me in a certain direction when I'm just trying, my present self is trying to enjoy the movie as it is in front of me.
Because the Disney dub are the Fanning sisters, right?
Yes.
Yeah.
And it was kind of like the thing where like Disney were kind of, They were going like through redubbing all of the Ghibli films.
Yeah.
And there was this kind of
except
element.
Except Mononoke.
Yeah. And also there's, they didn't redub Kiki. Did they?
They didn't, but what they did do, which I'm very thankful for, is they restored the soundtrack, because the Kirsten Dunst dub of Kiki uses like some shitty music sometimes, which is not the original film.
Ah, right, the original
and
one.
They restored that recently, yeah, which is very cool. But yeah, like they were sort of like going through, and they were kind of getting a star for each dub, right?
James Van Der Beek.
James Van Der, who's that? I don't even know who that is.
Dawson from Dawson's Creek.
Jesus Christ, who was he?
He was Patsy.
Right. Wait.
Oh. Yeah. Oh well, I'm sure we spoke about it on the Laputa episode ages ago. Yeah. But like, I always hated that decision because it's like, no, he's a 12-year-old boy. He's not 17. But what makes that film cool is that he's a 12-year-old who has a job and lives alone, and you know, is dealing with the
living in a grown-up world, man.
Exactly. Yeah. But like, yeah, Totoro is the Fanning sisters. I never really liked the dub. When I first saw the film, I was 18, and I was a snotty animation student, and I was watching the Japanese version.
Mm. And that's the version I watched today. I had never watched it before.
Have you not? You know, it's definitely my favorite. Like, I don't like the Disney dub.
Mm-hmm.
Because I feel like they're too kid actor about it. Even though it's quite natural, it's still a little bit too affected. Miyazaki always went for, like, you know, and this is why I prefer, like, the dub of Ponyo as well.
Mm-hmm.
Which is kind of like Totoro's sister film, I think. But,
I would say so.
Yeah, like, the Japanese dub is great, but it really grates sometimes. Like, when Mei is crying, it's like fingernails on a blackboard. It's not pleasant to listen to. And that's kind of why I like it, because it feels a bit more real.
Well, yeah, because when a kid's screaming and crying in the same room you're in, even if it's not your kid, it's just like, you kind of get this unpleasant feeling, like, you know, depending on who you are, just like, oh, that's a really uncomfortable sounding noise. Or if you're if you're more of a parent or paternally minded, then you're just like, oh man, like,
yeah,
you kind of feel like you want to jump in because like a child is in distress, and that's just like, we're hardwired to like want to jump in when that's going on.
It is that lizard. Yeah. It's that lizard brain, or I guess maybe later than the lizard brain reaction. Yeah. Where you are like, oh no, there is a thing that is crying. I need to help. Yeah.
Yeah. I need to get involved somehow. But yeah, and I got that feeling probably more so from when, like you just pointed out, like, I got that more so watching the film in the original Japanese than I did in watching it in English. Even both times, like, compared to both dubs that I've heard before.
Yeah. And the dubs are fine. They're fine. But the other thing as well is that the Japanese version was directed by Miyazaki. The voices were. And he's very meticulous about directing the voices. As you, people may or may not know, like, Japanese animation, they usually do the voices last.
Yes.
Rather than before, which is the norm with, like, every other type of animation that you can think of. But the reason Miyazaki says is because he feels like he hones the characters when he's drawing them. Mm-hmm. And then he gets by the time the voice actors arrive, he knows exactly what performance he needs out of them.
The tricky part is coaching them out of the actors themselves.
Yeah, and if you've seen, like, the making of Spirited Away, you can see where he's, like, you know, the cadence of a line and the rhythm and the tone is, like, absolutely in his mind, and he struggles to coax it out of his voice actors.
Mm-hmm.
So, yeah, I think that's why it's my preferred version. But it seems like a shame because it's such a pretty film. I mean, it's not a very talky film, so you're not reading that many subtitles. But main star is, like, the art, really. The images.
Yeah, agreed.
The first time I saw the subtitle version, actually, was in a cinema. So the only time I've seen it on a big screen was in the Japanese version.
Oh, wow.
Lucky you.
So that was quite an experience. It was a few years ago at the local animation festival showed a lot of the Studio Ghibli films, and to be honest, I own most of them, and I thought, you know, I'm not really in the position to be throwing money away to go and see every Ghibli film that they're showing, but
right.
I couldn't not go and see Miyazaki Totoro, so even though I owned it, possibly, I don't know if I owned it twice over at that point, or three times, and had the art book and everything, I still went to see it anyway, and it was, you know, it was like seeing it for the first time again, seeing it in all the detail and everything, and discovering, yes, Cat Bus is definitely a boy, and...
Yes!
Yeah.
I remember that shocking me when I rewatched them, like, oh.
Okay. You don't get it on a fuzzy VHS version, no.
Well, actually, recently I had the absolute, like, joy of... having my brother walk in on me watching Pompoko. and he just sort of like walked past and he was like, oh, Dan's watching another Japanese cartoon. All right, fine. And I was like, no, wait 2 seconds. and he was like, what is happening? How is this on TV at 11 o'clock in the afternoon, in the morning? I wondered that myself, actually. Like, oh, okay, that's like completely uncut, and
it's anatomically correct. No, sorry,
uncut is the wrong word to use about that area. sorry.
It's fine.
It's not rewatching the film isn't like watching a film like. I don't know, like a plot-heavy film where it's like, oh, I've seen that story. I know how that story ends. That's the opposite of the point with this film.
Mm-hmm.
It's... main thing is the experience of watching it.
Mm-hmm.
And it's like, you get to rediscover it even more than, like, rewatching Macbeth or something. It's like, oh, yeah, here's that bit. Like, it washes over you just in a more magical way, really, than any other type of storytelling.
Yeah. So, yeah, Cat Bus... we can all agree, regardless of gender, Cat Bus is amazing, and the design of that thing is fantastic.
I'm gonna say because of gender, it's amazing. So like we're jumping ahead of it. They've only just got into this new house.
Yes, we are.
They've met the boy Kanta.
Oh right. I originally forgot about him in this movie, but then I'm like, oh, I remember him.
It's like, it was weird watching this film today because it was like, it almost played, like in hindsight, I mean, obviously it wasn't this because it was made in 1988,
mm-hmm.
but it almost plays like a greatest hits of Miyazaki. Like, the boy is wearing a sailor's hat, right?
He is.
Like, the boy in Ponyo. One of my favorite things about that boy is in the production notes for Totoro, like in the, it's called like a project proposal. Miyazaki says about him, like, what's say about him? He's a simple boy with simple desires and a simple mind, and he likes planes, and that's that.
Like, yes, he does. Yeah, he has a figure plane or like a model plane.
Yeah, like
oh well, okay. Later on, when you see the plane, that plane is exactly the same plane that is in The Wind Rises at the start.
I'm not surprised by
of his dream, right? It plays like Miyazaki's greatest hits because he's got the soot sprites, which are in Spirited Away, and
yep,
and you know it's all there. It's very much of a piece. And like Miyazaki, he's conscious of that. he riffs on his own stuff a lot. And there are things like, you know, quite obvious ones, like in Ponyo when the mum says, like, "I'm happy as can be," like the song of Totoro.
Oh, right.
Right? And then there are, like, less obvious ones, which are, like, him reusing compositions, which you'll only notice if you're a freak like me and you've, like, you know, watched these films far too much. Anyway, so, yeah, they move into this house and, like, it's a fixer-upper.
Yep. I think I remember, like, the exact line when the family pulls up and the girls run out in a rush to see their new home, and they look at the state of it. It's like, and they're like, it's completely, like, it's like a complete wreck, and they're just screaming, like, happily, "Oh my god, our house is a wreck," and they start playing with one of the old banisters, or, like, wood pillars, and
one of the supporting pillars.
Yeah, one of the supporting pillars, and it's completely rotted out. And they are just having a blast of pushing this thing around, and this, like, wooden debris is falling. I think a block of wood clonks May in the head. But they just keep going. They just keep rolling with it. They're super excited. Regardless of the state of the house, they're super excited to be here.
I mean, if I did that as a kid, I would, you know, I'd be on the floor, because I'd just be, like, whacked around the head for being such a pain. And, you know, that wouldn't at all been appreciated. But,
well, their dad's very chill.
Like, he deserves some kind of parenting war, because he kind of knows, and there's so much in this movie, it's kind of genius, like, where you're reading between the lines.
Mm-hmm.
And with that, he kind of just goes, okay, they need to let off some steam, because we've been on the road, and, you know, we're in a new exciting place, and they just need to do whatever they need to do, like, and he just sort of lets them get on with it.
And he kind of gives them jobs to do, too, when once they've initially gotten a lot of the exploration out of their system, he gives them a job to do, like, go look for the stairs for the upper floor, because we need to air that out. And then they take off like lightning, just, you know.
And all throughout the sequence, you get the real setup of May and Satsuki's relationship, where May is, like, repeating everything that Satsuki says.
Oh yeah, that's
like, it's rotten, it's rotten, and, like, it's, you know, the tree, oh, there's a tree, and
that is very true.
That is a quintessential younger sibling behavior.
But isn't it unbelievable that it's one of those, like, observations which is so good, but you've never seen it in a film before, like, at least done that well, that truthfully. Yes.
Yeah,
he absolutely nails the older and younger sibling thing. Like, it's scary how good it is.
Well, not just any type of siblings, because siblings can have different types of relationships with each other depending on how old the age difference between them. But you can tell that there is, you know, Satsuki is definitely a lot older than May, but they still have such a good relationship with each other, like, that May can be following Satsuki around. And Satsuki, you know, doesn't mind. Like, as most, you know, some other siblings would, like, stop following me. I want to be by myself.
Well, there's the whole thing.
Let her follow her and do her own thing.
There's the whole thing that the film doesn't drop until, like, I think, like, minute 15 or maybe 20, which is Mom's ill.
Yes.
And, like, she's in a hospital, and it's implied, like, I think just through context clues, that she has, like, TB. Is that right?
Yeah.
I don't know if they specific, because I remember...
It's never said, but...
Yeah.
Which is, like, another genius part of the film, because, like, a lesser film would explain that to you. But because it's from their point of view, it's just, look, Mum's in hospital.
Mm-hmm.
And the other thing the film could have done very easily is for them to visit her in hospital and for it to be, like, sentimental.
Mm.
It could have been, like, you know, which is, I think this is one of the worst hospital scenes in modern cinema. Not a bad film, but Guardians of the Galaxy. It could have been...
Oh, in the beginning?
It could have been cloyingly sentimental, and it's not. The mum smiles because she's putting on a brave face for the kids. Mm-hmm. And that's something else you can read between the lines. So, you know, the reality is she's in hospital, but, you know, like, even truer reality is that she's putting on a brave face for her kids.
Yeah, she is.
And it's like, it's something that I spoke to Chris about this off air. Like, it's the whole situation of having a loved one be in hospital, and I mean, the film just kind of nails that limbo that life becomes when that happens.
Yeah.
And the feel, and even like that thing with the mum putting on a brave face. I've seen that. Like, I've done that when I was a kid as well. Like, I've visited grandparents in hospital. My mum would be like, "Oh, he doesn't look very well," and I'm like, "Oh, but he was smiling." And she's like, "Yeah, he was." Like, you know. And then I realized now, oh, they were smiling because I was there. It wasn't that, you know, once the door shut and we left, it was back to, you know,
recovering in silence or in
another reality.
Stasis.
Yeah. Yeah. So
being in a hospital is being in stasis more or less in terms of, you know, because you have to, you know, you have to take care of yourself and recover, but it's like not much really happens.
It's boring, I think, is the main thing.
Yeah, it's boring.
That's kind of set up now.
Mm-hmm.
You understand, oh, they have moved because mum, and that's like the first point at which like the film's like real underlying beating heart like reveals itself. And then everything you see the dad do after that, you realize is a very good dad. Like, he is being playful for the kids.
Mm-hmm.
And it's
especially
not that
moving into a new place too, which is, I love the, you know, the night, their first night in that new house, and the wind, you know, is, they're worried the wind's going to blow down the house while they're all taking a bath together. And he just starts laughing just as a way to keep the girls, like, you know, not thinking about the, you know, if that did happen.
Yeah, because, like, they discovered the soot sprites at the start. I think made up, actually.
Mm-hmm.
And,
that's
yeah.
The first supernatural.
That's supernatural number one.
Yeah.
And she thinks she catches it, and her hands are just filthy. she gets in trouble for that.
Tracks it around the house.
The thing that I think that we haven't actually said about the film yet, which is, I feel part of the whole, like, it being Miyazaki's first, most personal film,
mm-hmm.
at that point, is it's a very Japanese film.
Yes.
Like, it's such a good film that it has universal themes, and it plays like gangbusters to any culture. That being said, it's very Japanese.
Well, yeah.
Taken
away from that when you're in the Japanese countryside.
It's obviously aimed at an international audience. The film envisages a serious, disorientating combination of cultures that produces a nowhere land more confusing than fascinating. The characters, despite obvious Japanese names, have Anglo features. Didn't you know that?
No.
This I am quoting. I am quoting from the review published by Variety in 1993.
Oh my goodness.
By someone called Leonard Clady, who did not take the Totoro. He describes it as displaying no more than adequate televisual technical craft. This simple family saga poses no threat to the commercial dominance of Disney cartoons.
Are you kidding me?
I'm sorry, I'm not. This is a genuine review published by a professional.
Well, so he's okay, but the thing, professional, he's like, he's the guy who is like at the car show, and he sees Chitty Chitty Bang Bang, and he's like, "What's that piece of junk? I much prefer Lightning McQueen over here."
Writer-director Hayao Miyazaki has essentially padded a television half hour into a sluggish theatrical feature. With a half century of Disney full animation at one's disposal, the rigid backgrounds and limited character movements appear dull and crude when viewed on a large screen.
Oh!
The muted pastels, homogenized pictorial style, and vapid storyline all add up to an extremely lonely neighborhood when Totoro moves into theaters. How can one person be so wrong? about everything.
That hurts me. All of those words from describing Totoro hurts me.
The thing is, it's like all those things that he said is what I like. The pacing, the fact that it's the antithesis to Disney style at the time, like
because
around
guess
this.
What? There's more to animation than Disney, folks.
That's, and I think this is why the film becomes popular,
mm-hmm.
right? And particularly in, because it's my understanding that it was vaguely shown on TV a bit more in country, in like places like Italy and other European countries.
Mm-hmm.
But it's, I mean, like around like 10 years ago is when you started seeing it being parodied on like South Park.
Mm-hmm.
And Bob's Burgers. Like before,
the turkey is amazing.
It's incredible, but like they couldn't have done that weirdly enough with the movie like, you know, 15 years ago.
Mm-hmm.
And around like 10 years ago, I think is when people like started to rediscover it. Like at least in English-speaking territories.
Yeah.
And it's like, it's become more iconic, I feel like, since then. And to the point where when you hear people talking about animation, it's like, oh, you know, I don't... You know, Pixar Disney's fine, but I love the Japanese stuff. And they mean Totoro. But the thing is that actually Totoro is not even typical of Japanese animation. Miyazaki went against the grain in Japan. Like, Japanese animation was just as brash and commercial and hyperactive.
Especially in the 80s, right?
Yeah, exactly. Yeah, absolutely. And it took a lot for him to fight through that. And I think it's very easy to forget that. It's not the norm. Like, there's Japanese animation and then there's Ghibli, and not to like put it above everything else, but it's different. It's working off a different rule book.
Well, I think it's easy to forget that Totoro, you know, at the time was going against the grain in Japanese cinema and, you know, animation, because of how successful and how it's marketed now. With, you know, the Totoro plushies and everything, like, you know, you would assume that, oh, this had to have been a hit from the beginning, and it was a, you know, I'm sure it did catch on, but it's just,
I mean, there are certain things,
different reasons than people might
there's assume. Yeah, I think there are certain things which he did which are like he knew were going to be good, like having the song, like mm-hmm. he knew that was going to be like an appealing, cool thing to do for kids, like to have mm-hmm. the song at the start where it's like, here's a song to start the film, and it's very sort of he's writing like that perfect line of speaking to kids at their level mm-hmm. without being condescending.
Yeah,
it's like it's not quite as bad as like an Illumination film finishing with a song and a dance.
Yeah,
like for some reason that feels more cynical than a gentle little film with like kazoos. And, you know, anyway, but it's a very Japanese film, and it's got things in it that are just like, that means that he was kind of accused of being nostalgic.
Well, it's not just, you know, and it's a particular time period in Japan too, that maybe not first, because I, at first when I started watching the film, I wasn't entirely 100% when this was supposed to be set, but yes. Then I not until I looked into it, this is post-war. This is
post-war. Oh yes, yeah. Definitely. Yeah.
It clicked with me now rewatching the movie and seeing, oh my gosh, the boy's name again. The boy who like shows up, he's wearing the hat, right?
Kanta.
Kanta. He's wearing the sailor hat, and I'm like, oh. Okay, yeah, post-war. I guess that kind of, like, is supposed to be a visual cue for that, but I'm not sure. He might... I always, for the longest time thought he was just wearing a nice hat. Nice little sailor hat.
One of the ideas is that it's supposed to be at a time before... They say time before television. I mean, television existed in the 50s, but the average Japanese family wouldn't have had one, is the idea.
Yeah.
I think...
Supposed to be when people played outside.
That's the typical Miyazaki answer where it's like, it's not set in any particular year or any particular country. It's just, I mean, although this is obviously Japan in this case. Yeah, he wanted to be for television because he was done with, you know, the creeping. I mean, like in the 80s was when like video games started to creep into homes and things. I'm sure Miyazaki saw those and thought, you know, they were... Not the devil, but, you know.
Didn't like them at all.
The thing with Miyazaki, he's like a big barrel. He said himself, like, he's a barrel of contradictions. He was working in TV. He was contributing to that culture, you know? Mm-hmm. So, this was his film sort of just trying to get away from it, basically.
It's like, kids, watch this movie, then go outside. I mean, it's funny, speaking of video games, too, like, there are always those, every now and again, there are those video games that after you beat the game, it's like, congratulations, you've beat the game, now go outside. Do yourself a favor and go outside, take a victory lap.
Well, this is, and, like, when the film got very popular, actually, and mothers would run up to him saying, my kid watches your film every day, he was, like, horrified. He was, like... He was like, you know.
It's like, no, they should be outside.
They should be watching that video as a treat. And I think he said like once, like, they should watch a film like on their birthday and that's it. It's not, which is kind of, I think that's a bit much. But, you know, the point is that he made it as that. But he actually like put out a piece in, I think like, there was a thing called a Roman album, which is like a big magazine that was released along with the film, and they still release them now with anime movies. And there was an interview in there, and he was like saying his headline was that this is not a nostalgia piece. It's great that if you feel nostalgic watching it, but that wasn't his intention going in. His intention was to rediscover the things that he liked about childhood, and with that newfound like love of nature kind of thing. And I think like there is a film which is, you know, you've seen nostalgia pieces, and it's Stranger Things. It's something that kind of feels a little bit like it's trying too hard.
A little bit, yeah.
And I think this film just about escapes that. Like, there's enough where, like you're saying, it puts you in the time, and then there's enough where it's like, oh, this is just a story.
Yeah. I mean, the only hint that really picked up on was on, like, even before I picked up on the hat that Kanto was wearing, was the older phones. Was the only other real context clue about the actual, you know, when this was taking place. Other than that, it was just a nice little story in rural Japan.
The fact that there's like one phone in the village.
Yes, like, there's that.
There's one.
Go next door to borrow their phone.
And there's one school.
Yeah.
That is small enough to allow like someone like from another age group.
Oh right.
In for an afternoon. Yeah, so kind of going through the movie, Satsuki goes to school. She's sort of like, she's becoming like a surrogate mom for Mei a little bit.
Yeah, she makes bento lunches for all of them.
Very Japanese. Like she makes the lunch boxes for them. And she's sort of like, she assumes like some of the roles of mom. Like she talks to Mei in that way that older siblings sometimes do.
But also kind of like with a mother, like the kind of like the tone of a mom too.
Yeah, absolutely. Anyway, so like dad's working from home. he's getting on with this stuff. And what begins is probably my favorite sequence of the film. I think it's about 15 minutes. Maybe it might be.
I think you're right. I think it's just about that long.
My favorite sequence is just from Dad working and May running around the garden going, you'll be the flower shop. And then she's sort of like, she just is discovering the garden, basically.
Yeah, she's having a little day out.
And then she sees the first tiny little creature.
Mm-hmm.
And it's like a beautiful silent film. Like, it just, you know, the whole chase where she chases it underneath the house and she waits. And there's that shot, which is just, like, impressively long, where she's just waiting and the only thing moving is a butterfly.
Oh, and no, yeah, I love that shot because she's just like dead set focused on that hole, waiting for anything and anything to come out. You see an entire sequence of the butterfly flying by her, and then just at the end you see the two creatures sneaking out from a completely different exit point, and she only catches on when they actually start dropping acorns and they just take off into the woods.
And this is worth pointing out, this is about half an hour into the movie.
Yes.
And this is apparently Miyazaki originally wanted to have Totoro in the first scene. And Toshio Suzuki suggested that you should tease the audience and not have him until later. And he said, look at E.T.
What? Really?
I am absolutely shocked to hear that. Not because it's unexpected, but because I had a theory about why this became popular and E.T. being one of the main factors.
Huh. That, wow. Mind blown.
Yeah, this was on the special feature on the Blu-ray. But I saw today.
Well, There it is, because, like, it's easy to forget, like, how E.T. was the biggest film of all time.
It really was huge.
And, like, worldwide, it made a massive impact. So, it's kind of impossible for Miyazaki not to have been influenced by E.T. at the time that Totoro came out. Like, whether he liked it or not.
But I love that. I like the idea that, I mean, even it would have been interesting to see what Miyazaki would have wanted to do in terms of, you know, having him in the first scene. But I do appreciate that they decided to go with that idea of building up to that reveal, because then it makes his sudden appearance, or at least his appearance in the film, all that more special, because just May just finds him. She's chasing the two creatures. She's reaching for the acorns, you know, grabbing the acorns as she goes. Finds her way to the big tree, falls through the roots, and then boom, she's on his belly.
I wonder how much screen time he actually has. It's
not a whole heck of a lot in the grand scheme of things.
It's that classic ratio of like Jaws and the Joker and the Dark Knight.
Except this is
T-Rex in Jurassic Park.
Yeah.
Except this isn't a man eater or a child eater. This is a friendly forest spirit.
Well, it looks like one, but May isn't. May is not afraid.
No, she's not afraid.
She's not afraid. And she's not a liar.
No, she's certainly not a liar.
She'll
tell you.
She's not a liar, and she's not afraid. And she's the best. And she's funny. So, like, this is... you can't really... I mean, the star of that scene as well. So, two things about that previous scene.
Mm-hmm.
Animated by Makiko Fataki.
Yes.
My favorite, best, you know, the superstar who did Pony Running on the Waves and the Forest God in Mononoke and everything that's great in
that's
the world.
Personal.
So she animated that, and she also animated the next scene where May meets Totoro, and that's the scene that like is iconic and is always shown, like, whenever there's like even a passing reference to Miyazaki on TV. It's like, that's the scene. It's
May
on Totoro.
May and Totoro.
And that's the thing that's like parodied in South Park. And, but like the star of this, like in that scene, it's just the animation and the music.
Mm-hmm.
And the music is like, I think it's maybe the best. Well, yeah, it's hard to, it's stupid to say the best, but it's like, it's a really, really good score. And the film is 90 minutes, and the score runs 45 minutes.
Wow.
That gives you an idea how many quiet scenes there are in this movie. That's impressive.
Yeah, it's very impressive. And I think that's like, that has a lot to do with Takahata. Because don't forget, like at the time, Miyazaki and Takahata were, they were rivals, but they were, you know, they've been working together for years.
Yeah.
And there was, they spoke about, you know, to each other a lot. And Takahata made lots of suggestions. He was actually the one who suggested the art director, Kazuo Oga, to Miyazaki, which I'm sure he probably was kicking himself for, you know, when the film finished. But yeah, like I think that's the other star of the film is Kazuo Oga.
Okay, who, gotcha.
It was his first film working with Miyazaki.
Huh.
And he worked with Miyazaki like up until, I think his last film might have been Howl's Moving Castle.
Mm-hmm.
That was the last film that he worked with Miyazaki on. And he is like the one who is, you could probably credit him for the Ghibli background look.
Okay. Yeah.
Because up until that point, like, you know, Nausicaa and Laputa are very pretty films, but the Ghibli look, the one that becomes the sort of albatross around Miyazaki's neck for the next, like, for the rest of his career is this, is like the trees and the lushness.
Yeah, the very and highly the realism. Detailed backgrounds.
Yeah, and Kazuo Oga, I think he's like the unsung star of this film for me. He painted like lots of the key backgrounds, and later on in the film, one of the most amazing things he does is slowly, through no trickery, just with cuts, shows an early summer evening drawing it, and the background slowly, you know, go through the goes through sunset basically. So yeah, we were with May and she's seen Totoro and she tells Dad and Satsuki and they don't believe her. Actually, no, they don't not believe her. Satsuki doesn't believe her, but Dad is like,
he humors in a good parenting maneuver. He humors her and says, you were really super lucky. You got to meet like the Lord of the Mountain or the Lord of this forest.
Yeah, and Satsuki's so like jealous.
Yeah, no, she's like, man, why did I get that?
God, I made you lunch, and this is, you know, like, this is no good.
I don't get to see this super cool thing.
Yeah, and that was something that Miyazaki, like, he made, because he had, like, this one image of a girl at a bus stop. That was it, for ages. And then at some point he realized, okay, well, for a kid, he was very logical. He was like, okay, for a kid to be at a bus stop in the dark, they've got to kind of be old enough to be doing that.
Yeah.
And but he was like, but also it only makes sense that a young girl would be able to see these little creatures. Like he thinks there's something special about very young, it's seeing things, right?
The magic of being young.
And yeah, and it makes a lot of sense. So he was like, oh, okay, well, I guess it has to be two girls. And then he's like, well, I can make them sisters. And then that was when the story actually started to, everything else came after that.
That's really cool. I love it how that it really starts with that one scene that everyone, like, we, you know, you, if you look at the poster for even Ghibli Fest, it is the shot of Totoro and the two girls in the rain.
It's unbelievably iconic. Even to the point now, when you see a bus stop in an animated film, you're like, is that a Totoro reference?
Yeah, but that's, it is that very scene where they are going to meet their father, who has gone to work in the university for the day, and he's taking a train and bus back, and it's been pouring rain, and the girl's like, well, he forgot his umbrella, so we should go and take him his umbrella when he gets off the bus. So they go, they get to the bus stop, they wait. The bus that they thought was carrying him wasn't the one, so they wait for hours and hours. May falls asleep, and Satsuki, being the good older sister, carries her on her back. And then while they're waiting, Totoro just kind of appears out of nowhere and is just standing in the rain with a leaf on his face, or on his head, to stop the rain. And Satsuki gives him the umbrella. And I love the animation on Totoro here, because at first he's trying to figure out how to hold the umbrella. And then she's like, no, you got to hold it like this. And then he holds it. And then he starts realizing that the raindrops that were always bugging him when he was standing there are not bugging him anymore. And he's like really super happy about this.
Yeah, and like, you wouldn't think of that, would you? I'm always stunned by that moment, because it's like, oh yeah, he wouldn't know how to hold the umbrella.
Well, no, because he's a forest spirit. He's just kind of like, I've just used what's naturally around me. This is a strange and magical thing you've gifted me here.
Yeah, and his way of thanking her is by, you know, like, becoming the most terrifying thing in the forest. So she's not... he jumps and
all the rain stops. The rain literally like does a quick downpour and then it just stops. I'm like, if you could stop it from the beginning,
I guess the rain does stop off at that point. I read that as just like he's shaking all of the loose droplets in the tree.
Oh yeah, I guess that would make sense.
And the rain has stopped anyway.
Mm.
See, the film does this. It's so tricky. It's like there are lots of moments where it's like, oh, did that happen? Or is that... Or, because when they find...
Was it a dream or not a dream? We'll get there later. But was it a dream or not a dream?
Yeah, exactly. So, okay. But this is when the film introduces its main star. The frog.
I'm sorry, I know, I want to talk about the frog, but...
There's no better scene ender than just, like, everyone's just absolutely elated because they've met the cat last with Victoria, and it's like, how do you end that scene? There's no other way than just a good old... And, you know, I wouldn't be surprised if that was Miyazaki.
You think so?
Yeah, as the voice of the frog.
That'd be funny. Well, isn't that because they have the frog, or no, like, they show the frog while they're at the bus stop, and then the father comes back after Totoro's gone off on the cat bus, and, you know, the girls are super excited, they both got to meet Totoro again, and are telling them all about it, and...
Well, Satsuki's, like, met him, like, she's not seen him before.
Yeah.
So she's like, this is the best, it's so good, she writes her mom.
Mm-hmm.
It's the best thing that's ever happened to her in her stupid little life.
Mm-hmm.
So harsh.
this is when the tentpole scenes like begin.
Yeah.
These are like the films that like become, these are the scenes that become the most iconic, and the ones which are I just can't get over the fact that Miyazaki had the confidence to just go like,
mm-hmm,
these scenes are enough to be my tentpole scenes in the film.
Yeah.
I have enough confidence that I can imbue these scenes with as much interest and life.
And charm. Lots of charm, too.
And a heck of a lot of charm for them to be enough. I don't know many other filmmakers in live action or animation who would have that confidence.
Because it's so easy to do wrong. It's so easy to make that, to have something like that, or have the idea of doing something like that, and then missing the mark because you're not, like, you don't really get to the soul of the moment. But
he found
a way to do it.
It works because it's grounded, and he's got, like, okay, he just runs through the logic again of, like, okay, well, there are two girls. Okay, they're at the bus stop. Okay, what's happening? Well, one's falling asleep. How do kids fall asleep? And he, like, does the perfect... you know, thing where, like, she may, like, catches her head falling.
Yes, yes.
And then Satsuki's like, okay, you're too tired to stand, so I'll give you a piggyback. And so he gives her a piggyback. and she's like kind of awkwardly propping the
umbrella. That stuff, yeah,
all of that stuff is why the scene works, because it's like it's grounding it in the reality that when Totoro appears, it seems unbelievable.
And the
frog is the best. What's there to say? What else?
Very
is there
good
to
looking
say?
Frog, I want to say.
Yeah. Oh, we skipped the scene about school, which is quite sweet.
Oh yeah, I did enjoy that too.
Because that's the first day that like the dad is away from university and May's left with Granny.
Yeah.
And
she wants to be with her sister because
it's so typical, isn't it?
Yeah.
Like, it's so typical of a kid that age who's missing her mom to cause a scene.
Yeah, and to the point where it's like the only person that she can reach out to was her sibling. It's like she literally demanded to come to school. Surprisingly, they wouldn't allow this nowadays. She is allowed to sit in the class.
I don't know if that's like a nowadays thing. I think that's more like a country thing. That was how I read that. I read that as like, look, we are the only school for miles, and there is not a play group. There's not a kindergarten where she can go. She can join.
Mm-hmm. I'm sorry we didn't talk about that earlier, because I did actually really enjoy that scene.
It's not important. I just like May because she's funny and like she's drawing and she's like, yeah. I was like, what's that? She's like, well, it's Totoro, of course. It's
Yeah, it's like, yeah, it's Totoro, of course. Like, the name of the thing that I literally just made up because he actually can't tell me what his name is, because I don't know if he can actually talk. He just talks and roars.
Well, this is the other thing, is that Miyazaki consciously wanted Totoro to not be an understandable thing.
Yeah.
He wanted it to be he wanted to be a large character.
Mm-hmm.
And he wanted the ambiguity of whether it was smart or whether it was stupid.
Mm-hmm.
If it was there or if it was not. And, like, he asked the animators to look, like, in the Roman album, actually, for the film, which I've got, there are, like, notes where it says, like, make sure, like, he's not actually looking directly at anything. Have his eyes like slightly, his pupils slightly too far apart, so it looks like he's totally spaced out. the thing that I think I want to completely dispel, because the meme has completely ruined it.
Oh no!
Is that
Miyazaki? Curse you, memes!
Miyazaki has a sense of humor. And he was being interviewed about Totoro, and he said, like, yeah. And the other thing is that I knew he needed a big smile, because kids are simple, and you show them a big smile, and they're like, oh, it's fine. There's a smile. You know, it's... So he's playing his audience there.
Mm-hmm.
Very much. He's like, look, there's a smile. Fine. It's fine.
He's a scamp.
There's the cat bus. I mean, we're not skipping over it, but
no, it's that very scene with the bus when they think, oh, that's Dad's bus. It's like, no, it is a giant cat bus.
It's still really creepy. I don't trust it still.
It's amazing, cat bus.
It's amazing. I'm more freaked out by it. I never really understood
for them, though. It doesn't. Well, we'll get there to the end of the film, but it does something nice for them.
It does. I just, like most people, I just get I mainly get Cheshire Cat vibes from it.
That's fair, and it's right to be unnerved by something that reminds you of the Cheshire Cat, because the Cheshire Cat can be very unnerving.
Miyazaki's explanation of the cat bus is, what if there was like a cat spirit thing and it saw a bus one day and it decided, oh, that looks like fun, so I'll be a bus from now on.
That's so great! I love that explanation.
Which is, yeah, the only explanation you need for something which is also apparently the wind.
Perfect.
Fine. All right, so...
Do you think it used to be like cat cart or something? Cart, cat. Like, it used to be some more arcane... Maybe it used to be a train, and then it became cat bus replacement service.
Okay, here's the thing. I've seen May and the Cat Kitten Bus.
Yeah.
The sequel.
Mm-hmm.
Have you guys seen that?
No, I haven't.
No, you can't see it.
You're not allowed to see it. If you are a detective, you can see it. But, but like in that, there is a cat train bus, cat bus train.
Oh my gosh.
And there is a whole forest of them. Like, Miyazaki just like absolutely just goes, look, this is a sequel.
Why can't they release this for everybody? It's not.
I'll give the audio. When he dies, that is when you're going to get it. Not before then. But like, there's a cat Airbus.
Oh my god!
Which is like a giant zeppelin with a cat bus face, oh, and it's got like literally hundreds of legs. Yeah, it's crazy. So, you know, there's a whole franchise.
Wow.
Waiting to be made.
Also, in about 2008, there was an amazing project called the Totoro Forest Project, organized in it was organized by like some Pixar animators and artists and everything. I think the guy who founded Tonko House.
Yeah, okay, but yeah. Do you know his actual Totoro connection?
No.
He has a very strong... His Totoro connection is that he is married to the girl upon who May was based.
Oh!
That's quite a strong connection.
Yeah, he's like, he married into like Ghibli royalty, you could say. Yeah.
Yeah. Well, they
because he was on Japanese. He was on Japanese TV, like promoting Tonka House, and yeah, his way of like getting the kids on his side was, I'm married to May.
That's wild.
To raise money for the Totoro Forest Project, they got loads of artists from around the world to do Totoro inspired artwork, and there was a it's got people like Pete Docter and. Amazing people like that.
Oh, wow.
Oh, it's a super, super, super like limited edition artbook.
Yes, that I have.
I didn't. What? I'm shocked.
I have it. I am.
Yeah, there's the one of Sully with Totoro at the bus stop, right?
Oh, yeah.
There was like a few hours in which you could get it. And
damn.
I was working, and I had my parents like, "Can you not go? Then can they help me out?" And they managed to get it to me, and it's one of my most prized possessions.
I bet it. That's, you can't get that book anymore.
I mean,
you can if you want to spend hundreds of dollars on it. But
yeah,
no.
Why is this a piece of artwork with Sully and Totoro in the same frame and no one told me?
We are just about at the halfway point.
I think we should,
to wrapping this up. I mean,
all right, so the next scene pretty much is the tree. They plant the acorns that Totoro gives them, and
yeah, and they do a little dance, and then it turns into this gigantic tree, and then they wake up in the morning, and the tree is not there, but the sprouts did indeed sprout. You know, the things that they planted did indeed sprout, and they're like, oh, and they start running around and giddy glee, like, it was a dream, but not a dream.
Yeah, like in any other movie, again, that would be a joke. Like, the joke would be, you dumb kids, you're just imagining that. Like, look, it's a tiny sprout. But the sprout is like such a triumph.
Well, yeah, because they grew something. This was something that they worked hard and grew themselves.
Yeah.
So they're proud of it.
All right. So then, like, the film really just, like, for what happens then is like, it's in the morning. Sasuke's with the grandma at the water pump.
I think they're picking up vegetables.
They're picking up vegetables. The reason I mentioned the water pump is because that was apparently a very nostalgic thing for Japanese audiences, and in fact, it's like it hit so much that it's actually something you can do at the Ghibli Museum.
Oh, in that's the garden. Funny. Oh.
There's like a water pump, and everyone tries it. Like it's look at me with a water pump. Like it's. Yeah, but yeah, okay, so pretty much from this point on, the film just like it just barrels towards the end.
Yeah, it from a slow, steady pace, it goes to like vroom, like it turns in from like a tiny casual Sunday drive to Grand Prix.
But my favorite type of movies do that, where it's like they don't waste any time towards the end. Right, so they get the she's with Granny, and Sasuke gets the telegram.
Yes,
which is like very trickily worded by some asshole at the hospital.
Contact the hospital immediately, and it's just like, and of course Sasuke's like, oh no, something happened to mom.
And it's something gets very sad and scary.
Mm-hmm.
And she's like, look, I gotta find mom. And May's there. No, and she's really, like,
of course. There's no drama in this film, of course. It's Variety Man.
No look, drama.
There's no off Totoro. There's no greater drama than a kid being lost. And I mean, not that that's not true in life either. But you know, it is so sincere about it.
It was, and that's what makes it, like, that's what makes the tension actually build in that sequence, because, I mean, also even the lead up to that, where we have, you know, Sasuke trying to grapple with the situation that, she reaches out to her dad to try and, inform him, but she still has to deal with the idea of not knowing what's going on and what could possibly happen to her mom. What the telegram means, like...
The way Miyazaki frames that is amazing. It's a very long shot when Sasuke's on the phone and she's trying to, like, she obviously needs to, like, connect to the operator, and then she needs to make a long-distance call.
Mm-hmm.
And it's framed on her, like, in a profile shot.
Yeah, yeah.
And there's a certain way that Miyazaki uses profile shots. Which is, I mean, usually the like conventional filmmaking rule is not to do them because they can have the effect of alienating. But Miyazaki uses them, and it's always a very powerful shot whenever he uses a profile shot, because it feels like you are in the room watching her. Like, that is the angle from which you would, if you were panicking in the room, that's the angle from which you'd see Sasuke. It's something to look out for, like, in his movies. He always is very sparing with his profile shots like that. And, like, in his fantasy films, they are, like, when the characters are taking in the epicness of the journey. But also, like, in I don't really know what they mean, but they're in his films a lot and they're very powerful, basically. But we're getting to it, guys. The next big star of we've spoken about him already.
Yes, we have.
Is literally waiting for May around the corner.
Yeah. Well, because the lead up to that is the fact that, you know, when she gets the telegram, Sasuke gets the telegram, she runs off because she needs to get in touch with her dad. And she tells May, you know, you got to stay with Granny, stay here. But of course, as we all know, May is not afraid and she's not a liar. So she runs right after.
She's not afraid. She's a little shit. She's not a liar.
And gets lost in the process of trying to find her big sister. All the while carrying this ear of corn, which she's said she's going to give to her mom to help her feel better. And
which is like perfect.
Yeah. And yeah. that's exactly when we run into our next star, which is that terrifying goat.
The bloody goat. The bloody
unicorn's like, I want that.
I was with a group of friends like in the summer, and we were just like drinking at the pub, and someone mentioned, oh, I saw Totoro the other day. And the first thing my friend said, mm-hmm. who was next to me, when someone said, I saw Totoro, was he went, bloody goat.
That's awesome. Like,
deep
bloody
cut.
Goat.
The bloody goat.
That's, I'm sorry, that's got to be the episode title.
Yeah.
Please, give me the episode title.
She's arguing with Satsuki's, you know, and okay, and then Satsuki is like at her lowest point.
Yeah.
With grandma. She's like, look, it's really bad. What if mom dies?
Yeah.
And May is watching this, and it's unclear whether she what she overhears. But the fact is that Satsuki is crying her eyes out.
Mm-hmm.
And it's kind of like a weird, it's like, it's, she's actually drawn like a little bit more realistically.
Yeah, she is. I noticed there's like a, her face changes a little bit in terms to like, to look more like a kid. Not just like a idealist look of a kid, but a kid, actual kid crying, you know, the face scrunches up and...
Yeah, and me being a nerd, I know who did it. It was it was Shinji Otsuka.
Okay.
Who is like, I mean, by the time that Ponyo comes out, Miyazaki calls him the most perfect animator.
Oh, wow. That's quite high praise.
Yeah, he's like, he's famed for, by the time that like they're working on Princess Mononoke, for having scenes that no one corrects. Usually in Japanese
animation. That's impressive.
Yeah, usually in Japanese animation, like, and I'm sure you've seen it on like behind the scenes things, like Miyazaki will like slam down a new piece of paper and be like, no, this is how the character's drawn. And, you know,
redraw the scene. He wants it drawn his way.
Exactly. Apparently, Shinji Otsuka just gets it and his thing's pretty much untouched. Anyway, yeah, so this is when May runs away.
Yeah, so she wants to take that corn, that ear of corn that she protected from the goat. She wants to take it to her mom because she believes without
She's
the shadow of the doubt that it, well, without the shadow of the doubt, mom eats this, she'll get better and she'll come home.
Mommy, she get, and it's not far.
Yeah.
Which is all wrong.
Yeah, like even the you know, granny says like that would take a grown up 3 hours to get to that hospital and she just took off. Like,
yeah.
Why?
So the thing that like absolutely makes my heart like it doesn't make my heart sink, it like the bottom drops out of my stomach.
Mm-hmm.
Is the way the scene plays out.
Yeah.
Where it's not big that she's lost. It's not like, May's missing! It's
yeah.
just, he starts doing shots of Satsuki going, May? And then there's no answer.
Mm-hmm.
And then, like, she's in a bigger area. May? No answer.
It's a very slow build. But
but that's how it feels when someone goes missing. Like,
yeah.
If you've ever, like, you know, been out with a kid in a busy area, like
you lose them for a minute. It's like,
yeah,
and
yeah, exactly.
She puts herself ragged too. Like even when they realize that she's not there anymore, and you know she runs around. She's you know talking to farmers out in the fields. You know, a person just driving by. Like, have you seen a little girl? She's four.
She runs into an arsehole on a bike.
Yes.
He screams really loudly. He's like, you idiot!
Well,
what are you doing?
Because she jumps in front of the motorcycle is what he's going not full speed, but you know, fast enough that he could have hurt a small child and he not stopped in time.
He's like such a jerk, and he's got like the sweetest spoken girlfriend.
Apparently.
He's so timid. And she's like, oh, and then he finds out where she's from. Like how far she's walked.
Yeah, how far how far she's traveled to try.
And he just goes like, "Wow, good luck to you."
Like, yeah, it's at that point I'm like, "Wow, you're a jerk. You're not going to even offer to help." Like, that's awful.
Yeah, and
but,
then so
oh,
and then like Kanta arrives and he's like, look, they found a sandal in the pond.
I'd forgotten about that scene. I'm like, oh no. Oh no, 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 no. Even though I've seen this movie, I know how it ends.
And it just, it from the second that happened, the film just cuts to the pond. Mm-hmm. And you see the sandal in the pond, mm-hmm. which is another Miyazaki riff because it's the shoe in the water in mm-hmm. in Chihiro as well.
Yeah, Spirited Away.
But like it's very bad news. And then Satsuki runs to where they found the shoe with Granny.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, all these people are helping her out, trying to get the shoe and look around to see if they can, you know, if this was indeed Maze and if she's actually in that pond. But Satsuki,
well, this is the only scene where I think Miyazaki just about plays his luck and just about gets away with it.
Yeah.
Is he plays that beat so long when Granny's like, is it her shoe?
Yeah.
And like, there's a pause where like Satsuki's like catching her breath.
Mm-hmm.
And it's like, it's a little bit shitty. Like, it's a very dramatic thing to do.
Yeah, yeah.
You know, like, to play that beat. And he really does drag that moment out.
He does.
But it's not hers. And she. So then, like,
everyone takes a deep breath, like, oh, thank God.
Yeah, Satsuki turns to the tree and she sees a tree in the distance. She's like, oh, I gotta go see Totoro. I gotta see my mate.
Like, I've tried looking and asking everyone I can find. I'm out of options. I need to go talk to Totoro.
Yeah, and at her lowest point is when she's granted access to Totoro's lair for the first time.
Yep.
When, you know, she's only in like a classic fairy tale thing. She's only able to see him when it is like needed.
Yes, yeah.
Which is like, the thing about the film is, I think Miyazaki said like he wanted to consciously avoid fairy tale or folk tale influences.
Mm-hmm.
And whilst they were not direct influences, they're not direct references.
Yeah.
It's like
it's hard to ignore
in the tradition. Yeah.
It's very hard to ignore.
And so like basically Totoro goes he goes like you know, oh, I'll just call the bus. And then the bus ride.
I'll call you a bus.
But it's almost like, and I don't, it's not a damning thing to say at all, but like, it's almost like the film is like looking at its watch and going, we've got to wrap this shit up. And like, and the sign on the cat bus just goes like, hospital May.
Yeah.
It's just going to find May.
It's delightful. I don't know how it gets away with it, but it's one of those things where, like, in practice, it does.
Mm-hmm.
On paper, it doesn't. On paper, like, if that was in a script, you'd be like, no.
Oh, isn't like, that silly?
Yeah, yeah, but it just comes at the right time in the film, mm-hmm. and you buy it.
Mm-hmm.
And like poor May, she's gotten herself quite badly lost. Like, yeah. She had no plan to get about lost.
No, especially if this is probably the only few times she's gone to this hospital. She's been riding with her dad on a bicycle, and it's just like, well, I could have sworn I was paying attention to the road signs, but I really, in all
honesty, she's obviously like fallen over a few times, and she's all like,
oh my God. It breaks your heart.
Yeah, and it's pretty much just like from that point, cuts to the hospital, and you get like a great little scene with the dad and the mom.
Mm-hmm.
Find out she's actually all right. She's not dying.
No.
Yeah, she's like, I don't know why they called you. Like, I had a cold. And it turns out that she's probably going to be like in there a week longer.
Yeah.
Not long enough. I mean, just a little bit longer, but not long enough that's like, oh, this is really serious. Like, no, she's fine.
But what's really, I think that review based, that bad old review, says somebody, oh, you know, turns out to be a cold or whatever. But the point is, it's from their perspective that it's this big apocalyptic possible event.
But yeah, so this scene is lovely, and there's a line that I picked out where the dad just says, "We learn to cope." which is, you know, the film in a nutshell, basically.
Yeah.
They learned to cope, whether it was for him, like, believing in all of that stuff and playing along with it, and for the kids, it being real. Yeah, it's so good. But it's so easy. I can understand where that review would be coming from. Like, it's easy to watch this film and mistake its lightness of touch for nothing at all.
Mm-hmm.
Or, it could be if you're not paying attention. But there's this very sort of, like, weird line, the fine line between that and nothing happening. And I feel like the later Ghibli films that were not directed by Miyazaki, the ones which are trying to be Ghibli films, maybe suffer from that. I think one of the best things that Roger Ebert ever said about, he said this, unfortunately, about the last Ghibli film that he managed to review, which was From Up on Poppy Hill.
Okay.
Directed by Goro Miyazaki. And he called it Weak Tea.
I like that film.
Okay, so I need to reevaluate that film, because my current evaluation of it is no good. Weak Tea. But I think that is the difference between getting this right and not getting it right. It's like the same art of, like, don't make the tea too weak and don't over brew it.
Yeah, exactly.
And I think this is why this is a perfect film, because it's like, it's absolutely not perfect on paper, and it's absolutely, it's got a couple of flaws, maybe, but it's still perfect.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah, and it's kind of miraculous, but it also, like, it becomes something that Miyazaki wants to shake off. By the time that he's making Princess Mononoke, he's called Porco Rosso, like, his, which is his next film. It's Kiki and then Porco Rosso, right?
Yeah.
And he's called Porco Rosso, like, a little bit of an indulgent piece in, like, recently, which I think might be true. It's a very fun film, but it's quite indulgent. And then by the time he's getting back into animation, he's making Princess Mononoke. And, like, the reason he makes that is because it's a reaction to everyone by that point in the 90s going, oh, this is what Ghibli film is. It's magical bullshit. Makes no sense. And lovely backgrounds. And, you know, it's like his origin story. And, like I said, like the albatross that he has around his neck for the rest of his career. And I think that's, something that people probably don't talking about, no?
You know, if anyone's ever asked me what my favourite Miyazaki film is, I would always say, I can't choose. It's too hard. And I've always said, you know, it's between a few, and, you know, it's like Totoro, Princess Mononoke, Spirited Away. I can't choose. But when I thought about it recently, and I thought, when I really think about it, if I could only have one to watch the rest of my life, it'd easily be Totoro. So Totoro is my favourite Miyazaki film, my favourite Ghibli film, and therefore probably my favourite film. So I really love this film quite a lot, as you can tell, I would say. Would you agree with me? How would you... Well, I suppose Ponyo for you, Dan, because it's your...
Well... Yeah, again, it's like it's impossible to, like, I think I'm able to, like, you can't make Ponyo without, he can't make Ponyo without having made Totoro.
Exactly.
Right? So I feel like it's kind of like, okay, like, at the moment, I'm coming around to thinking that The Last Jedi might be my favourite Star Wars film.
Because it's the best one.
Because it's the best movie. Yeah, I thank you, Chris. You are correct. Yeah, you win someday. You absolutely win. But I also keep telling myself, like, yeah, you can't say that without the setup of Force Awakens, and you can't say that without Star Wars 77, right?
Yeah.
So I probably have the same answer for Ponyo, where it's like, yeah, I love that, but you can't have that without Totoro. Like, Totoro is the film where Miyazaki, like, makes a name. Like, Totoro is the movie that, you know, made Akira Kurosawa cry.
Wow.
Right? Like, that is the moment when Miyazaki is considered a, not just like a good animation guy, like a great Japanese director.
Mm-hmm.
And he is considered amongst, like, Kurosawa, you know, and all the rest of it. It's a genius, it is magic, the film, because, like, I mean, like, to get into really some really nerdy shit, it has, like, there's this thing in film studies which someone coined the term average shot count.
That which is dirty.
Okay, which is basically, within a film there are so many cuts, so many shots.
Yeah.
Sorry, average shot length, ASL. I'm reappropriating it. And the average shot length of the film is much longer than most animated films. Which just basically means that the shots have more breathing time.
Mm-hmm.
But the crazy thing is that the average shot count of this is less than... So the average shot count is shorter than Raiders of the Lost Ark.
Hmm.
Which is an action film. And this is not an action film.
That is certainly not.
There's some magic in there to that. Like, that Miyazaki makes it feel like it's a complete holiday and that you've lived with it just being a tight 90 minutes. There's just a magic trick there that I don't know how he pulled off. And yeah, it's a classic. Yeah, I think it's... Let's put it this way. It's his greatest film in that no one else could have made it.
Yeah. No, that I can see that hands down.
It's conceivable that someone else could have made probably even Princess Mononoke. It's conceivable that someone could have made maybe even Spirited Away. Like, it's a very unique film and it's got lots of Miyazaki touches, but yeah, I'm glad that he spent the 15 years sitting on this idea and letting it percolate. Because yeah, it's a perfect film. I don't know. What is that to say? It's Totoro. It's good to go back to the film. It's good to go back to the film because sometimes it's one of those things which has become so iconic.
Yeah,
it's like, oh, someone's got a Totoro like handbag. Like, wow, it's just like recognizing Mickey Mouse now. It's like,
yeah, really, like,
yeah,
he's everywhere.
Yeah, so it's good to go back to the film and just, like, okay, it's still a masterpiece.
One thing I would say, though, is if, to anyone listening, if they do ever get a chance to see it on the big screen, jump at it, because it is, if you've only ever seen it at home, it is amazing to get to see it.
And if you ever see Totoro, jump at it, like,
yeah, yeah,
on its stomach, and he will fly off on his little... What is it, like a little dreidel?
Oh my gosh.
It's like a little spinning top.
Yeah, it's a spinning top.
I love the logic of, like, yeah, no, he can't fly. That's ridiculous. He needs a spinning top to fly.
He needs something. He needs to be standing on top of something.
All right. I think we've thanks for listening to our 4-hour takedown.
But there's so much to cover in this movie. Like, it's like we have to go, yeah, you have to take your time. Like, just much like the movie takes its time to go through these, you know, this little journey with these two little girls. Like, we have to take our time to go over, like, okay, you know, like, what what is it about this film that really kind of just draws us in and, you know, has made it such a huge, like, a somewhat belated but still very big, like, icon and, you know, something that we all look, you know, a lot of people who've seen it look fondly back on, you know, all save that one review. But
mainly I think it's the characters and the observations. It's like, you know, when you leaf through a very, very good artist's sketchbook, you'll see like little observations they make about how people stand or how people look at things or how people pick things up that you can only really just get from observing people. And there are moments in this film which feel like that, where it's just like, oh my god, that's exactly how little kids do that.
That's exactly
how they react in that situation.
Mm-hmm.
And that's what makes it universal, despite the whole, you know, sharing a bath with your dad and
the very
bento box thing.
Yeah, this movie is a treasure, and it was one of the very first early, like, Ghibli, you know, films I was exposed to, and, like, anything, like, I saw probably, I mean, Castle in the Sky and Totoro are my first two, so, like, I got to see two, like, I got to see the commercialized, but still very charming action film, and then I got to see the various, the much softer, like, you know, out there side of Miyazaki, and from, you know, everything, every Ghibli film that I've seen since then has been based off those first two experiences. And it's, you know, it's like I found films that I like even more since then. And even still, like, every film that I have seen come out of that studio has been judged by those first two movies. So it's like,
It's a very easy film to, like, go compared to, like, something that's spectacular. But it's quietly brilliant.
I appreciate it for that quiet brilliance, because I like films that are about quieter character moments or character development, and or just like you said, it's a holiday. It is a nice little escape holiday that, you know, if, you know, when life is really kind of throwing crap at you, like you said, the one line that the father has at the end of the film, we learn to cope. This is a movie to cope.
Yeah.
This is a coping movie.
If we're just doing sort of random bits, just one thing I noticed that I didn't really take in was when they're looking for May after she first encounters Totoro, and the dad crawls up the tree. When they call up the passageway up there. And he finds her hat and he puts it on. And that just seems like that's such a fun, that's the kind of thing you do with a child, with children.
I'm a bit silly.
He's fun dad, basically.
He is a very fun dad.
And I thought, that's perfectly observed.
You know what, Miyazaki steals that exact beat from himself in The Wind Rises. Jiro is courting the other character who has TB in the Miyazaki film. When he's courting her and he catches the hat and he puts it on and he takes a bow.
I take it back, he's such a hack. I'm kidding.
I mean, look, I'm going to be disappointed if the next Miyazaki film is anything less than a big riff on everything he's ever done.
Wouldn't that be spectacular? I'd like to see that. But yeah, Totoro, I love it. Always will.
That's great.
I'm so glad that talking about it for this episode and Ghibli Fest gave me an excuse to watch it again. Not that I need one, but, you know, just like, I hadn't thought about it in a while, and
it was years.
A really hectic weekend. It was exactly what I needed to watch, to just kind of chill out.
Oh, and for anyone who points out, we know that it was released with Grave of Fireflies, but...
Yeah.
I know, we've said everything.
So you watch Grave of the Fireflies, then you watch Totoro to cope.
No, it wasn't that, though. They tried it both ways. Is that right, Chris?
I don't know. I've always wondered which way they showed them.
The first thing I heard was that it was Totoro than Grave of the Fireflies, because it was like,
oh no,
if the kids get bored, we can leave, kind of thing.
Like, oh my god.
Or like, it's too late now, the grown-up film is on.
Oh wow.
But I also heard that they tried it both ways.
Mm-hmm.
And then there seems,
yeah, it's...
Then they're expecting the end to turn out very differently.
Yep.
Yeah, I mean, yeah, at least Grave of the Fireflies, like, it doesn't beat around the bush and it opens with, I'm dead. Like, it's not... Yeah.
Alright.
Cool.
Cool, yeah, indeed. So, thank you very much for joining us. And it's been another fascinating chat, and we'll be back soon with more animation topics. And hopefully soon we'll do our Princess Mononoke episode.
Yeah, we're rounding out the Ghibli library. We've covered quite a bit of their films now, but we'll have to take count of the ones we haven't talked about.
It was like his last chance to make an action film, because Suzuki pitched it to him.
We'll be working our way through. And we will be back with more fun. And you can follow everything that we do on animationforadults.com. You can follow us on Twitter, AFA blog. You can find us on Facebook, on Tumblr, on Pinterest, on Instagram, on Google+, and on YouTube. You can support us on Patreon at patreon.com/animationforadults, or buy us a virtual Ko-fi on Ko-fi, or however you say it. You can follow me personally on Twitter at Mr. Christor. Where can we find you, Dan?
You can find me on Twitter at Hanu.
Where can we find you, Rachel?
I'm mostly on Twitter at Fail2Ninja.
And you can find the cat bus wherever you need it. So,
just give
yeah.
it a shout. It'll come to you.
Yeah, it's a little thing we'll flip down to literally whoever you are. Yeah.
All right, everyone. Have a great week. Goodbye.
Hey, everybody.
Bye.
9, now available at John Lewis and Partners. With the S Pen, you can master your presentations by clicking through slides with ease, or take the ultimate selfie from up to 10 meters away. With the Note's most powerful battery yet, it'll last as long as you need. John Lewis and Partners. For us, it's personal. See online for details.